Time for It Says in the Papers from Valerie Cox.
Children of farmers are three times more likely to go to college. That's the headline on the Irish Independent, which dips into a new report from the Higher Education Authority. Catherine Donnelly says it puts the spotlight on how one's address and family background remain significant predictors of whether or not you will get a degree. Also on the front page, abortion case girl got lost in the system. It says the HSE was informed that there were serious concerns for the mental health of the young woman when she was 14 weeks pregnant and actively seeking abortion. The Irish Times leads with this story and says the revelation raises new questions about the HSE's role in her care and why she was not referred at this stage to a GP, who could then refer her on to a psychiatrist under the terms of the Protection of Life During Pregnancy Act. Mairis Houston says most parties will agree that on this occasion the Act failed to offer guidance to doctors on the most appropriate response to a request for termination that is made on the cusp of viability when a pregnancy approaches 24 weeks gestation. The Irish Examiner leads with another medical story. Catherine Shanahan reporting that patients not fit for day surgery could end up going under the knife because a significant number of hospitals do not routinely conduct pre-operative assessments to identify potential risks. Lack of patient checks puts lives at risk is the headline there. Also on the front of the Examiner, a warning from the Society of Operations Engineers about the risks of fitting second-hand tyres to cars following an increase in road fatalities. Owen English says it has also called for an automatic 6-month driving ban for motorists with the maximum 12 penalty points. And for the Irish Mirror and the Irish Daily Star, their lead is all about Pat Kenny, who, according to the Star, has signed a megabucks deal with UTV Ireland that will net him a massive €1 million over 5 years. It says the former Late Late Show host will return to our screens in 2015. In other stories, Sam Griffin in The Independent says Irish Airlines have been put on alert amid fears that seismic activity at Iceland's largest volcano could cause a new ash cloud. The Times continues its series on country life. Tim O'Brien has been to Finnay on the border of counties Westmeath and Cavan, where 3-year-old Cara Fitzsimons is the only pupil signed up for September's intake of junior infants in the local national school. But the small number of young children is only one fact of life in Finnay, writes O'Brien. All the papers report that Rose of Tralee host Zahi O'Shea underwent the Ice Bucket Challenge on Monday night. This involves raising funds for charitable causes by dumping buckets of ice and freezing water onto the participants. He then nominated Ryan Tubridy, Ray Darcy and Marty Whelan. Mr. Tubridy and Mr. Whelan both underwent the stunt on air yesterday morning, writes Fiacra O'Kyunny in The Examiner, although he notes that RTE bosses will perhaps be less than pleased at the thought of its top stars sneezing and spluttering. The Philadelphia Rose, Maria Walsh, was last night crowned as the Rose of Tralee. And Ronan McGreevy in The Times notes that another feature of the night was a comic turn from the North Carolina Rose, who described herself as a perfectly refined Southern belle. The bigger the hair, the closer to Jesus. And a letter writer to The Times, Frank Byrne from Dublin, says, obviously, it would be churlish to complain about an annual parade of pulchritudinous ladies participating in a personality contest. However, perhaps the time has come to consider a similar competition for male contestants. I suggest the Thorn of Tremore has a pleasing ring to it, he writes.
Valerie Cox, thank you very much indeed. 12 minutes past seven. Over to Brian Finn for the early business news and one of our big food companies.
Glanbia half-year results out this morning. Christopher, good performance overall from the Nutrition and Dairy Ingredients Group. Group revenue is up over 10% to near €1.8 billion. Earnings per share, that's a key measure of growth, is up 11% to around 32.5 cents. And when you drill down into the results, global performance nutrition, that's its food supplements and exercise nutrition, Nutrition's division. That's doing very well, a key driver of growth, and it performed very strongly with revenue up 17%. Global Ingredients holding its own, but Dairy Ireland had a tough half with revenue down around 7% due to lower agribusiness sales.
You mentioned the word global there several times. Of course, Glanbia, big exporter. In these half-year results, anything about the Russian sanctions?
The impact of Russian sanctions wouldn't have been felt in the first half as they were ramped up around August time, but we probably would expect to see some kind of effect in the second half of the year. And Glanbia do anticipate that revenue growth will slow down for the full year, especially in its international markets. And Russian sanctions are mentioned as a possible contributor, but so too is increased competition in the US market. But they anticipate that Dairy Ireland will put in a better performance in the second half, which will shore up the weaker performance elsewhere. And overall, the company is reiterating its guidance of 8 to 10% growth in earnings per share. And we'll be hearing from Glanbia Group Managing Director Siobhan Talbot in the later bulletin. In other news, Goodbody Stockbroker says we can reach a deficit target of less than 3% of GDP without introducing any new austerity measures in the next budget. In its latest economic commentary, its chief economist Dermot O'Leary says water charges will bring in €500 million, and that will leave the government with some room to introduce measures to improve medium-term growth capacity, such as an increase in capital spending and a reduction in the income tax burden. It says average GDP growth will come in around 3.5% over the next 3 years, and it expects the government deficit this year to come in at 3.7% of GDP, well below the budget target of 4.8%, and coming in next year below 3%, around 2.5% they anticipate. And finally, just on the currencies this morning, the euro trading at $1.33 and 80.1 pence sterling, Christopher.
We're going to Missouri in the United States, where the news appears on this side of the Atlantic to be getting ever more grave. Yesterday, a second black man was shot dead by police in St. Louis, close to Ferguson, where Michael Brown was killed last Saturday week. Michael Brown's shooting, of course, by a white police officer, has led to days of community protest and violent confrontations with police, up to and including just a short while ago. Meanwhile, the US Attorney General Eric Holder is due to visit Ferguson at the request of President Barack Obama in the coming hours to assess the situation there. Well, earlier I spoke to CBS News correspondent Steve Futterman. He was at the scene just a few minutes ago in Ferguson, where more arrests were taking place.
Well, we know it was much different than the Michael Brown killing. This gentleman was apparently taking items from a store. He was confronted by police, and this gentleman, according to people who knew him, they describe him as mentally challenged. He did have some emotional issues. But as police were confronting him, he displayed a knife. He lunged towards two police, and that's when he was shot and killed. And the police are saying they did exactly what they were supposed to do.
Is it possible for you at this point to determine whether or not the community can separate the Michael Brown killing from this second tragedy?
It seems at this point, and we're late in the night right now on Tuesday night, it seems that the people here in Ferguson this evening have not really brought that up. There have been some people who have complained that perhaps that was a bit too much force. When someone only has a knife, they said, could you have used a taser? Could you have shot him somewhere else? But it has not aroused any large emotions like we've seen here the last week or so.
Well, you're on the streets of Ferguson for us right now. What have you been witnessing this evening?
Well, it was very peaceful until the end, which is somewhat similar to last night. It began with around several hundred people marching around and around and around in this quarter-mile area, which has been the main focus of the protest and, of course, the violence as well. The police were essentially doing nothing. They were letting them march and march. Finally, those who were marching declared the march was over. That's when the problem began, because there were maybe 100, 150 people who were still in this area, and they would not leave. And that's when the problems began. Police put on their riot gear. They gave them warnings. They moved in pretending they were about to make arrests, and that forced many of these stragglers to say, that's enough, I'm leaving. In the end, around 2-3 dozen protesters remained. And as we're talking, they are being arrested. No tear gas has been fired tonight. I have not heard any shots fired tonight. Some bottles were thrown at police. We did see that. But it's been much less confrontational as far as tear gas and gunfire than we've seen the last couple of evenings.
Does that give you any cause for optimism that what's been happening over successive nights in Ferguson may be coming to an end? Or are you worried, indeed, that the opposite is the case and indeed these protests and these confrontations may spread to other parts of Missouri and indeed other parts of the U.S.?
At this moment, we have seen from Sunday to Monday to Tuesday, which is still here in the U.S., we've seen the intensity, the emotions diminish. Now, obviously, anything can change, but we're ending each night sort of the same way with a confrontation, but the first two nights it ended with tear gas confrontations. Tonight, so far, it's still going on. We've had no tear gas deployed. It's been much less a show of force than we saw the first two nights. Again, it was a show of force. I'm not trying to say that there weren't maybe dozens and dozens of police lined up, ready to move in. They were there, but it just didn't have the same 800-pound gorilla, if you will. The police were not acting as rough as they did the first couple of nights. I think that's how I would refer to it.
Is the decision by President Obama to send the Attorney General to Ferguson, is that attracting any sort of comment? Is that helping to soothe or to quell the situation?
It's not really having much impact. A bit of impact, maybe. It's really symbolic, the move by Holder to come here. He will come to this area. We've not been given the schedule. We expect it's likely he will meet with Michael Brown's family or some representatives. He will, I guess, tour this area. He will meet with officials. He'll probably issue a statement saying that the Justice Department will make sure justice is served. He may make a statement. He may hold a news conference, but it's largely symbolic. Doesn't hurt. It's not. It's good symbolism, but I don't think it's going to change anything dramatically.
So as of now, then, are you expecting to be in Ferguson in much the same position as you are for us at this point in time tomorrow?
Yeah, I think we will be back, and maybe it will be less intense on Wednesday than it was on Tuesday, which was less than Monday, which was less than Sunday. Again, we've had diminishing tension each night. The tension has been there. I'm not trying to say it's all gone. It's not even close to being gone, but it is less each night. And you have the number of people who are being called agitators, that number seems to be dwindling as well.
And that was Steve Futterman, CBS News correspondent, speaking to us just a few minutes ago from Ferguson in Missouri. It's not just journalists, though, who've been observing what's going on. A number of human rights organizations have sent representatives to Ferguson to assess police actions there dealing with protest and indeed confrontation. Human Rights Watch is one of them. Alba Morales is a criminal justice researcher with that organization, and she also spoke to us a little earlier. I asked her, first of all, what she had witnessed in Ferguson.
We've spoken to many witnesses who have been present at protests, and we do acknowledge that police have a very difficult and very important job in protecting the public, but we've spoken to enough people who have been present at times when police have used tactics like rubber bullets, tear gas. I'm sure you've all seen the pictures of the very militarized armored personnel carriers, the riot gear, and we believe that has the effect of intimidating the protesters and trying to interfere with their right to assemble. I've spoken to people, a few people who've acknowledged that police are ordering crowds to disperse and then not giving them the opportunity to disperse. I listened to some audio the other day taken by a journalist who was present when I counted no more than 3 seconds between the initial order to disperse being given, and you could hear the tear gas canisters being fired. And those are all very, very troubling when looked at under a human rights lens.
In your blog, your most recent blog, you've been talking about people saying that the mood there, it feels very much like us, the community, against them when it comes to the police. And you're also saying it feels, and this is a mood description almost, that the law doesn't get into trouble when the law breaks the law.
That's another concern of ours, is accountability. There need to be accountability mechanisms when we give the police a monopoly on power. They're the police. And when you give somebody that much power, there need to be mechanisms for when a citizen has a complaint, where they feel their rights have been violated.
As we've been reporting it over the last number of days, as we've been hearing from Ferguson, there seems to be almost very much two elements to the situation. One, peaceful protest from people who live in the area, people who knew Michael Brown. Secondly, outside forces, elements coming into the area with the specific aim of looting are causing civil unrest.
Last night we were there fairly late and we did see some people who were pretty clearly agitators trying to convince the crowd, not so much looting, that we didn't see, but to convince the crowd to confront the police, urging them to rush the police lines. We saw a much larger group of community residents, including clergy. I don't know if they were residents of that particular community, but they definitely were speaking as if they were speaking from a local perspective, urging peace, saying, relax, this is not what we came here to do, everybody just relax. And everybody seems to acknowledge, including all the statements I've seen from law enforcement, that these agitators are a small group, and that they're very much outnumbered by people who are interested in simply gathering to express their outrage and frustration over the death of Michael Brown.
And that was Alba Morales of Human Rights Watch talking to us from Ferguson, where the US Attorney General is due to visit in the coming hours.
Another ceasefire ended in Gaza last night, with Israel claiming rockets were fired into Israel and a number of Israeli attacks on Gaza taking place. Israel has also pulled out of peace talks which were taking place in Cairo. On the line from Tel Aviv is journalist Ina Lazareva. Thanks for taking the call. Is it clear, first of all, how this latest breakdown of another ceasefire began?
Well, it seems to have been quite clear, yes. Yesterday afternoon, the sixth day of the ceasefire was in progress. We were all expecting to hear the results of ceasefire negotiations by midnight yesterday night, but suddenly there were three rockets that were fired from Gaza, and Israel responded furiously. Netanyahu went on TV to announce that rocket strikes would resume, and this indeed is what happened. And now this morning, the rocket strikes keep on happening on both sides. In Israel, over 70 rockets have been fired from Gaza. Israel's responded with missiles battering Gaza once again, killing at least, I believe, 11 people.
So 11 people killed in Gaza and in Israel?
In Israel, no one has been killed. No one has even been injured. Just the usual terror of people fleeing parts of the south because they're worried about rocket fire. But in where I am in Tel Aviv, life carries on as normal.
Now, the talks that have been taking place have been with, on one side, which are now suspended, were all about Israel insisting that Hamas give up its weapons, and Hamas insisting that the Palestinians insisting that the blockade of Gaza end. Had there been any sign before these talks broke up, had there been any sign that anyone could figure out of breaking that logjam?
Yeah, well, there were rumors coming out of Cairo that indeed there may have been a partial agreement on the table, meaning that not all the conditions that Hamas demanded and that Israel demanded would have been fulfilled, but some, for instance, like the lifting of opening up of the border between Gaza and Egypt, may have well been agreed between the Palestinians and the Egyptians. So it could well have been, though, had there not been this breach of ceasefire, there could have been more progress.
Hamas are saying that the wife and child of one leader of the organisation have been killed. What's known about that? How much is certain?
Yes, this is perhaps one of the most significant events that have happened in the past 24 hours. Over the course of the night, Israel targeted a house where the wife and daughter of the Hamas's military wing chief, Mohammed Deif, were staying. And now his wife and daughter have been killed. There was a third body, which remains as yet unidentified. People are speculating whether this is Mohammed Deif himself or not. If it is, this is a significant turning point in many ways, because it's one of the key commanders of Hamas who's been targeted.
All right, Ina Lazareva in Tel Aviv, thank you very much for taking the call. We'll take a break and then we'll have news and sport. Pádraic Láidre is here with sport. Morning, Pádraic.
Good morning, Cathal. Well, Arsenal drew 0-0 away to Besiktas of Turkey in the first leg of their Champions League playoff. The Gunners had midfielder Aaron Ramsey sent off on a second yellow card with 10 minutes remaining. Arsenal, though, will welcome back Germany World Cup winning trio Mesut Ozil, Pet Mertzacker and Lukas Podolski for the second leg at the Emirates Stadium this night week. Here's what the Arsenal manager Arsene Wenger had to say afterwards.
Yes, it was a difficult match. played at a great pace, and Besiktas played with 100% pace in the game and did fight for every single ball and was quick. And we needed a great level of concentration. We are maybe still a bit short physically in some situations, but overall it was a game played for 90 minutes at a great pace. I think nor the first yellow card nor the second yellow card was deserved for Aaron Ramsey. And when you see some of the fouls that have been made tonight and we go home with Ramsey, a red card, it's a bit unbelievable.
Tonight, Celtic are away to Maribor of Slovenia in the first leg of their Champions League playoff. That game will be shown live on RT2 television. The Republic of Ireland women's team played their last home match of their World Cup qualifying campaign tonight when they face Slovenia at Tallaght Stadium. That match kicks off at 7:30. Well, yesterday the Irish women's under-19s lost 4-0 to Denmark in a friendly international. Manchester United have reached an agreement to sign Argentina defender Marcos Rojo from Sporting Lisbon. As part of the deal, Nani will return to Lisbon on loan 7 years after he joined United from Lisbon. And Northern Ireland international Paddy McCourt has signed for English Championship side Brighton on a 1 year deal. Ireland's Fiona Doyle failed to emerge from her semi-final in the women's 100 metres breaststroke at the European Swimming Championships in Berlin. She finished 7th in her semi and was placed 13th of the 16 swimmers. Sarika McMahon returns to action today in the heats of the 200 metres individual medley. Brendan Hyland is in action in his main event, the 200 metres butterfly, while Nicholas Quinn and Dan Sweeney go in the 200 metres breaststroke heats. In racing, Louth trainer Harry Rogers sent out La Canada to win the Sligo GAA Race Day Handicap at Sligo last night. The 16-1 shot ridden by Conor King won by 2.5 lengths. The Judmont International is the feature race on the opening day of the 3-day festival at York. Aidan O'Brien's dual derby winner Australia is the favourite to win the prestigious event, with Michael Stout's Telescope also taking part. Meanwhile, preparations are continuing for the inaugural Irish Champions weekend, which will take place next month, with the Irish Champions Stakes meeting at Leopardstown on Saturday the 13th of September and the Irish St Ledger meeting at the Curragh the following day. The general manager of Leopardstown, Pat Keogh, spoke about their pricing strategy for the fixtures.
€20 to either Leopardstown or to the Curragh for the day, and then you can get a combined ticket for €30 for the 2 days, and €35 then includes the Curragh Trail on the Sunday morning. So, you know, when you look at the price of any sport, you know, when you look at comparable racing fixtures in the UK, this is very, very, very cheap and very competitive. And we've pitched it that way because we really want to attract as wide an audience as we possibly can. We've very ambitious targets for ourselves for attendances, and we hope that we will achieve those targets, and pricing it economically was a very important part of that.
At the IPC European Athletics Championships in Swansea, Derry sprinter Jason Smith was a convincing winner of his category of the 100 metres, clocking 10.78 seconds. John McCarthy was just outside the medals in the 400 metres, while Heather Jemison finished 8th in her 100 metres final. And in rugby, Leicester have signed New Zealand World Cup winner Brad Thorne. The 39-year-old lock will arrive at Welford Road within the next month.
The time is 23 minutes to 8 o'clock. The Irish Nurses and Midwives Organisation will protest later today at Our Lady of Lourdes Hospital in Drogheda over what the union says are hospital staffing shortages, it being too crowded and it having insufficient bed capacity. It says there's been a 55% increase in the number of patients waiting on trolleys. Well, Tony Fitzpatrick is the INMO's Industrial Relations Officer in the northeast of the country. He's on the line for us this morning. What form of protest will this take today?
Well, the protest we're holding today is a lunchtime protest between 1 and 2pm at the hospital gates. And essentially, as you've stated there, it's about the overcrowding within the emergency department at Our Lady of Lourdes Hospital, which, as you said, in July 2014 saw a 99% increase in the number of patients on trolleys waiting for a hospital bed. And that can be as many as 40 or 50 patients, admitted patients, waiting for a bed within the emergency department. And our members are concerned that it's extremely overcrowded, they're short-staffed, and they have grave difficulties in providing quality care to patients. But the two other issues are that the hospital has significant staffing, nursing and midwifery deficits. Management have confirmed that there's 92 whole-time equivalent staffing deficits throughout the hospital, which is impeding the ability of nursing staff and midwifery staff to provide care.
We'll come to that figure in a minute, because I think they are disputing the 92 number. But just for people who are needing to access the hospital around lunchtime today, this isn't a stoppage of any form. If people see people out protesting, it's a sort of a display of, if you like, unhappiness rather than anything more serious.
You're right. This is not industrial action. Patient care will not be affected in any way.
Hospital,
and this is a first step to highlight the problems that exist in the hospital.
Hospital management, the HSE, say they're well aware of your problems. There have been routine meetings. In fact, there's one on Friday. Why do you need to take this public?
Well, the meeting on Friday was only arranged last evening, and we wrote to management on Friday seeking engagement at the hospital. Indeed, I have a letter from hospital management on Monday stating that they believe further engagement was not going to produce anything at this time. And indeed, it's only from highlighting the issue via the media and having this lunchtime protest that management agreed to meet with us last evening. And we have a meeting arranged with the Assistant National Director for Acute Hospitals for Friday morning. But we need to highlight this problem because we are in July. We've seen a 55% increase on the number of patients on trolleys waiting for a hospital bed compared to 2013. And in July alone, we had a 99% increase. And if the figures are that high in the summer months, our members are looking towards November and December with dread because they know if it's bad in July, it'll be significantly worse later in the year. But there are significant problems in Our Lady of Lourdes Hospital. There is a difficulty getting access to a bed. We have patients spending 3 or 4 days on a trolley in a corridor waiting for a bed. On top of that, we have as many as 60 patients across the hospital group who are clinically discharged from the hospital and they cannot leave the hospital because there aren't step-down facilities. There aren't community nursing home beds. There aren't nursing home beds or community services to allow those patients to be discharged.
Okay, well, let's give something of the HSE response to this because you talk about staffing shortages. They say not 92 permanent vacancies, 67 or thereabouts permanent vacancies, which they say are made up for with agency staff and also overtime, particularly in difficult areas such as paediatrics and midwifery. In other words, they're saying that they're doing their absolute level best to ensure that there is the full complement of nursing in the hospital.
Well, first of all, the 92 whole time equivalent is the figure that the HSE gave to me at a meeting on the 31st of July, 2014. So the 92 whole time equivalent is management.
Well, okay,
figure.
It does seem quite a wide division, but yes.
And there is an over reliance on agency and overtime in this hospital. Indeed, staff are getting tired and burned out because they have been doing extra shifts continuously to try and keep the ship afloat. And the reality is there are not enough staff within the hospital. Management have stated 92 whole-time equivalent to us. And on top of that, the fact that they've 67, as they claim, deficits, that I presume is not counting the fact that there are maternity leaves and other leaves that are never replaced within the hospital. So I would believe our figures are more accurate based on the HSE explaining those figures and giving those figures to us.
Additionally, the hospital says in November, there will be an 18-bed clinical decision unit. Not quite sure what that means. I think it means pretty much as it says it is, almost a holding facility, if you like, for patients where there is further investigation required and doctors and multidisciplinary teams and so on need to make decisions on those people. But also they're saying that there's more private stock, long-term beds that will perhaps relieve the situation with bed blocking in the hospital.
But Christopher, the reality is we're in August and we have in excess of 60 patients who are clinically discharged that can't get out of the hospital. So those beds will be gobbled up immediately. And the reality is a clinical decisions unit, that is welcome. But the reality is 16 beds is not enough. In a number of 3 years ago, as part of reconfiguration of services, 97 beds were closed in the Louth County Hospital in Dundalk. They opened 40 beds in Our Lady of Lourdes Hospital, which left a deficit of 57 beds. Now, having a clinical discharge unit is not going to address that problem.
Clinical decision
unit,
yeah.
We need management to stop trying to deny the problem, accept that there is a really bad situation in Our Lady of Lourdes Hospital. There is a crisis in the hospital with regards to bed capacity and staffing, and they need to address it.
We leave it there, but thank you very much for joining us on the line, Tony Fitzpatrick of the INMO.
Now we're going to get an update on the situation in another of the world's trouble spots, continuing trouble spots. This is the city of a million roses, as Donetsk is known. It's about, in normal times, it's about the same size as Dublin, population of nearly a million people. But from where we hear overnight, there is fierce fighting between Ukrainian forces and pro-Russian rebels. And joining us from Donetsk is Associated Press Ukraine correspondent Peter Leonard. And thanks for taking the call. What's clear about where the fighting is taking place and how severe it is?
Well, from the centre of Donetsk where I'm sitting now, we hear a constant kind of rumble of artillery fire, and it comes pretty much from all directions, and that kind of tells us that The city is pretty much in a siege. I mean, wherever we go, whatever direction we go in, kind of encounter Ukrainian army checkpoints, and it's actually getting pretty hard to get out of the city. So essentially, the army offensive, the government offensive to squeeze out the kind of Russian separatists is getting pretty intense at this point.
Government forces are saying that they've already captured one part of the city. What's the situation for the? I said it was a population of nearly a million people. Are many people still left in the city?
Not that many. I mean, it's very hard to tell. Obviously, I mean, it is a city of a million people, and you know, the figures are very hard to get by. But I mean, you can kind of tell being on the streets that not that many people are left. A few cars around, very few shops open, and it's a very quiet city. I mean, usually it's kind of bustling, as you would imagine, for a city of this size. But at the moment, it's actually quite sort of mysteriously kind of quiet. Not mysteriously, I mean, it's logically quiet.
Peter, can I just interrupt you? It's not a great line, but there's one other thing I do want to ask you about, and this is the report from Russia that President Putin, according to Russian official sources, is going to meet his Ukrainian counterpart, Mr. Poroshenko, next week. What do you make of that?
Well, you know, the issue, I think, when it comes to leaders like this, they're not... it comes to personalities in the end, and I don't think these two people kind of greatly like each other's companies. And I don't expect any kind of great breakthrough from that, because the fact is that you know, these people don't see eye to eye, and the situation on the ground is so bitter and so bad that it's hard to see any kind of breakthrough coming out of that meeting.
All right, Peter Leonard in Donetsk, thank you very much for talking to us. It's 14 minutes to 8.
Students received offers of third-level education courses earlier this week, and today the Higher Education Authority will publish a consultation paper on a new access strategy for those groupings of young people underrepresented in third level. This year, Dublin City University has offered its largest ever number of college places to students from disadvantaged areas. Close to 300 students have been offered a place at the university through its access programme. Well, Louise Byrne has been meeting some of those heading to study at DCU.
I logged onto my computer and I went straight onto the website and took out my journal where I had my application number written and everything, and what I saw then, I really wasn't expecting to see. I had gotten my first choice, which was the multimedia course in DCU.
18-year-old Rebecca Merrigan from Ballymun in Dublin was one of the thousands of students eagerly checking on Monday morning as third-level college offers were released.
Afterwards, when I was looking at it, I was looking at the little accept button, and I was just like, I was almost afraid to touch it in case I clicked it wrong and my whole application just went out the window.
Rebecca was a participant in the Ballymun Initiative for Third Level Education, a project which links in with Dublin City University's Access Programme.
I found that very helpful coming up to the Leaving Cert, because I knew I kind of had a little tiny bit of leeway if I didn't quite get up to the mark that I thought I was going to. Back when my mum was going into secondary school herself, she kind of felt like there weren't a lot of opportunities available to her as a person from one of those areas. She's delighted for me, definitely, that there are resources, initiatives and schemes available to help me progress to third level education.
Classmates of Rebecca's at Trinity Comprehensive School, twins Leon and Tomás Dowd, were also offered places at DCU, becoming the first in their family to go to university.
Really helped us out with, you know, applying to college and finding out different routes into college, and we got to take trips to DCU all the time, and we did like shadowing day, and we got to find out about college and how to get into college.
I got 310 points on my Leaving Cert, but the course was 415. So I didn't think that any amount of reduced points could have gotten me more than 100 points off. So I had to go online to check it, and then I saw that it was true, so I obviously accepted. So yeah, it means a lot, and especially now that I'm going to a course I want to do and doing, moving toward a career that I've been looking forward to for a long time.
The three students have all benefited from DCU's Access programme. Its head is Eta Tobin.
We've had our largest intake of students this year, so it'll be in excess of 10% of the undergraduate student population are from Access. In DCU, DCU put aside 10% of its places for reduced point entry to ensure that students who most need the place would benefit from it. That's a really good model, and I think that's something that should be in place in every higher education institution in Ireland.
Eta says cutbacks in guidance counselling in schools is having a noticeable impact on students from disadvantaged areas.
Certainly in DESH Band 1 schools and in urban areas in particular, I think the difficulty has been that the guidance provision, the hours, has been cut back quite considerably. And students in those schools, generally they can't come home to a parent or a sibling who has experienced third level education. So their main support is the guidance counsellor in the school. If that's not there, that's hugely problematic.
For students who do progress to third level education, the impact can be considerable.
People who've gone through the scheme very much understand, obviously firsthand, the impact that it's had on their own lives, with progression on to employment, high paid employment that they otherwise would not have got into. Also on younger siblings in the family, suddenly the standard and the expectation is raised. And I think where people are given the opportunity, they will take it with both hands.
Nothing stands in my way as long as I have a good work ethic and the motivation and everything else.
No one in my family's gone on to college, and it's kind of really exciting, and my parents are definitely thrilled, and my brothers are really happy as well.
And that was Leon Dowd ending that report from Louise Byrne on DCU's Access programme.
9 minutes to eight. Brian Finn is back with more business.
Carl, thank you. Goodbody Stockbroker says we can reach a deficit target of less than 3% of GDP without introducing any new austerity measures in the next budget. In its latest economic commentary, Chief Economist Dermot O'Leary says the government should have room to reduce the income tax burden and to increase capital spending, which is at levels not seen since the lows of the 1980s right now. Nutrition and dairy ingredients group Glanbia has reported revenue up over 10% in the first half of the year to €1.8 billion. Earnings per share were up nearly 7%. Siobhan Talbot is Group Managing Director of Glanbia, and she joins us now. Siobhan, a good performance overall, but let's start at home with Dairy Ireland. It reported some challenging conditions for the first half. What was behind that?
Good morning, Brian. Yes, as you say, we're very pleased with the overall performance, where we delivered strongly relative to our overall guidance for the year of almost 12% adjusted earnings growth, driven particularly by our global platforms of performance nutrition and indeed global ingredients. You mentioned specifically Dairy Ireland. Yes, we've alluded to some challenges within our consumer products business and agribusiness in the past, but we're doing all the right things within that business. We've launched some really nice products under the Avonmore brand, and we do expect, in fact, the second half performance will be improved, and we do expect actually growth in that element of the business for the full year. I think it's important to remember too, in fact, that in Ireland, where we employ over almost 2,000 people, we are increasing our employment across areas such as our performance nutrition European head office, building obviously the facility in Bellevue. So a lot of positive things actually happening for the Glanbia organisation in an Irish context.
We saw Glanbia cut milk prices by 2 cents per litre in May. Do you envisage them falling much further?
It's very difficult to be prescriptive in terms of direction of milk prices. I think the main thing for the Glanbia organisation is having delivered a very strong first half result. We remain comfortable with our guidance for the full year to deliver 8 to 10% growth. And there are a number of factors impacting global dairy at the moment. Probably the primary reason for the reduction in milk prices in recent times, which are still very robust in historical context, is that global milk supply has been growing as a response indeed to higher prices. So there has been some reduction in recent times.
You mentioned the Global Performance Nutrition Division, which drove much of the growth for the period under review here. Just for people who may not be familiar with that division, what kind of products do you make there?
Yes, essentially our performance nutrition business supply high quality sports nutrition products predominantly in the US and increasingly internationally, including Ireland, to sports enthusiasts and athletes. So anybody really that's interested in health and wellness and exercise and recovery, which we can see is very much a global trend, take our products to help them achieve their performance goals as sport athletes. So a lot of our products are dairy based, so high quality products that help people in their recovery, whether you're a serious athlete or indeed somebody that's interested in health and wellness, like to take products such as our Optimum Nutrition products.
The Global Ingredients division held its own during the half year. You've announced a capital spending plan in that division. What does that involve?
Yes, we've announced this morning $60 million development. I think part of the Glanbia story in recent times has been a nice mix of development, both organically and by acquisition. We're very pleased with the opportunity to continue invest behind our facilities. And essentially what we're doing there is increasingly adding value to the milk pool that we have in the US. This investment will allow us to develop more of what we call the high-end whey protein products that particularly apply to the sports nutrition segment, and we'll be increasing our capacity in that space. We're also increasing our capability to extract other valuable components from the milk pool that are used in areas such as infant nutrition. So it plays very much to the strategy as an ingredient supplier producing high-quality, high-end dairy products and equally providing further raw materials to drive our performance nutrition business right across the globe.
If I could just ask you, Siobhan, about Russian sanctions. It was too early to be included in the first half results, but do you anticipate much of an impact for the full year?
The main thing overall is that we're sustaining our guidance for the full year of 8 to 10% and taking into account, in sustaining that, we're taking into account all the known news in relation to the Russian piece. Really for us, as indeed any global dairy player, it's an unhelpful development in a market that was starting to show some declines for the reasons I said earlier around global milk supply. So it is very much a piece that we're monitoring. As a global dairy player, the impact for us is an indirect one. Like all players, we're watching how it might dislocate the supply-demand dynamic of global dairy. It is a market indeed for our performance nutrition business on a more direct basis, but quite a small one in percentage terms. So really, as all players, we're watching it, monitoring it, and seeing how it will evolve. But I think the big thing at this point is that having had a very solid start to the year, we're sustaining our guidance in the 8 to 10%. For the full year.
Siobhan Talbot, Group Managing Director of Glanbia, thank you very much. Just on the currencies, the euro trading at $1.33 and around 80 pence sterling.
3 minutes to 8 o'clock. It was a little polar in the air this morning. What's the midweek weather got in store for us? It's over to Matt Aaron and Vincent O'Shea.
Hi, good morning from Matt Aaron. Yes, it's a cool but a bright start in most places this morning. Sunny breaks will occur widely during the forenoon, but cloud will increase. The day will be mostly dry, though the odd light passing shower may occur during the afternoon or early evening, especially across the north and west. Highest temperatures will range 15 to 17 degrees. Northwest winds will be light. Tonight will stay dry in most places with clear spells, but however, showery rain will get into the north and west late in the night. Westerly winds will be moderate, lowest temperatures 7 to 9 degrees. Tomorrow will be mostly cloudy, though a few short sunny breaks may occur during the morning. Upticks of showery rain will occur widely during the afternoon and evening, though, but amounts will be small in the south and east. Westerly winds will freshen as the day goes on, highest temperature 16 or 17 degrees. And the outlook is for it to stay cool and changeable until the latter part of the week with a good deal of dry weather, but it will turn wet and windy for Sunday and the early part of next week. In more detail, Friday will be a cool, bright and a dry day in most places, but a few light showers may occur in places. Winds from the northwest will be light. Saturday will be another dry and a bright day with a mix of cloudy and sunny spells. Winds will be light and variable, though it's going to stay cool for the time of year. Then, southeast winds will strengthen on Sunday and rain will spread in from the southwest during the afternoon and evening. That rain will be heavy and will persist for much of Sunday night too, before turning showery on Monday. Finally, I'll leave you with a recap on today. It'll be cool but bright with some sunny spells, dry apart from isolated showers. That's the forecast. Good morning.